Salve, salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut, this is Storied History, and this story is about the life of Santa Claus. It's Christmas time, at least where I am, so Merry Christmas. And for Christmas, we're going to talk about the life of Santa Claus. Santa Claus is a mythical figure. Santa Claus, if you have small children in your car, is 100% real and is definitely coming to your house in a few days. So you better be good for goodness sake. But if you don't have children present, Santa Claus is a mythical Christmas figure that has roots and origins that go back almost 1,800 years. That's how far back the roots of Santa Claus go if you're going to go back to the very beginning, which we are. Now, just to get this out of the way up front, this is going to be rather limited in scope, limited to Santa Claus and his roots and how he progressed through the centuries. That's all I'm going to be covering. The historical roots, the character, the individuals, some of the variations, and that's it. So in the same way that last year I did the Christmas carols, but I didn't really talk about anything except the Christmas carols themselves, which, by the way, if you haven't heard, is a very, very good episode, if I do say so myself. I played it for my nieces and nephews, and they really liked it. So this one is going to be about Santa Claus and Santa Claus only. I will not be covering the history of Christmas as a religious holiday or as a secular holiday or any of the other Christmas traditions and celebrations. Just Santa Claus. And on that note, I will once again take the advice of the Mad Hatter from Alice in Wonderland. I will begin at the beginning, and then when I reach the end, stop. So in the beginning, there was no Santa Claus. And Christmas was rather dour and a very solemn affair. There was only St. Nicholas of Myra. He was born sometime around 280 AD, so about 1750 years ago. He was born in a place called Myra, which is modern-day Turkey. He was an early Christian bishop of Greek ancestry during the time of basically the Roman Empire. He was called Nicholas the Wonder Worker. He is now the patron saint of sailors, merchants, archers, repentant thieves, children, bridesmaids, brewers, students, and unmarried people. Those saints do tend to get around. He was born to a very wealthy family, but it was somewhat sad development, but appropriate, actually, when you consider modern Christmas stories. His parents died when he was young, and he became an orphan. He was raised by his uncle, who was the Christian bishop of Myra. His uncle did not have any children, so apparently doted upon this young man. So he was an orphan, but he was raised happily. There is no evil relative in this story. At one point, his uncle predicted that Nicholas would grow up to spread joy and happiness to everyone around him, which he did, by all accounts. Nicholas became a man who was unconcerned with the things of the world. He didn't really care about his parents' money. And he did have money. His parents had left him quite a bit. And his uncle didn't take it. So this is not one of those Christmas stories about an evil man stealing money from orphans. No. When he became of age, he took control of all of his parents' wealth. And he proceeded to start to give it away. He was very, very generous. There are several stories about his early generosity, the most important of which, and the most famous of which, happens to do with three young women. They were growing up in Myra. Their father was very poor and was unable to provide his daughters with a dowry, which was a requirement for them to get married, a dowry being something that the father of the bride gives the groom's family. So he couldn't provide the dowry, so he couldn't get a groom, so no groom would accept his daughter's hand in marriage. And so he was going to have to get rid of his daughters by selling them into, shall we say, a profession, the oldest profession. They were going to have to become professional women. Good old St. Nicholas, or at this point, good young Nicholas, decided to help. And so what he did, according to legend, was to drop a small bag of gold coins down their chimney. It landed in the socks in front of the fireplace that had been washed and hung up to dry. This little sack of gold coins fell into the socks, and that was the dowry for one of the daughters. The poor man praised God, saying that it was a miracle and that God had granted him this gift, and he began to pray for his second daughter. And sure enough, the second night, it happened again. The third night, the youngest daughter, who was maybe rather more clever than her father and her older sisters, stayed up to see what was actually happening, to see if she could spot where the gold coins were coming from. And sure enough, when they dropped down the chimney, she went outside and caught Nicholas in the act. So his act of generosity was not completely anonymous and became rather well known. I should note that at this time, one of the reasons that he couldn't give the money to the man directly was because it would cause the man to lose face, to lose honor, because he was in need of charity, and he would then be in Nicholas's obligation. He would be in his debt for receiving this gift in order to protect his daughters. That was a really big deal in that place and at that time. The debt that incurred was important. Mutual obligation through gift giving was a really big deal. That's where the dowry came from, or the need for it, at least. It may be hard to understand now, but back then, a gift without obligation was essentially unthinkable. It was so important that this guy was literally going to have his children, his daughters, sold off to brothels rather than take the charity and incur that debt, that obligation, that losing of face and honor to a wealthy man. It's a strange thing, I know. It's a cultural difference that for some reason, the idea that you would accept charity from a wealthy person was more embarrassing and worse than if all three of your daughters became professional women. It is very bizarre, but it is true. Nicholas continued on doing things like this, giving his money away anonymously, giving gifts and helping people out anonymously. And it became something of a trend throughout the city. Then sometimes it was Nicholas. Most of the time in the beginning, I'm sure it was, but later, it wasn't. Because after he had given everything away, he became a bishop. He followed in his uncle's footsteps and became the Bishop of Myra. But the gift-giving continued, and it was still attributed to him. Was it him? No, it wasn't. How do we know that? Because he was completely broke, had given away all of his money, and then joined the church. But people were still giving things to one another in his name, because it was a way for people to help each other out, to help their relatives, to help their neighbors, their loved ones, their friends, without incurring an obligation. It was kind of like a bypass, a detour, a secret way to get around the cultural restrictions that had developed over time. And it worked. It was very, very successful. As a side note, and as a little bit of foreshadowing, what I will talk about at the very, very end of this episode, one of my absolute favorite Christmas movies, modern ones certainly, but favorite ones in general, is a modern one called Klaus, K-L-A-U-S. It is, in my opinion, a modern-day masterpiece. And there's a really great scene or series of scenes that have no dialogue to them. They're just kind of shown without commentary. But they're very rich if you understand what mutual obligation is. The notion of that mutual obligation was turned on its head in this movie when two warring factions in a town start to make peace. Some of the kids, because they've been told they have to be good in order to get toys, pick a group of berries and give them to their neighbor, who's in the other faction. Well, the neighbor opens the door. She sees these basket full of berries and these kids smiling and laughing and giggling, running away. And she's not happy. She doesn't treat this as a gift. She treats it as a debt that she now has to repay. So she retaliates by taking the berries and canning them, turning them into a basically delicious sugary jam or a treat, and she gives that to the kid's mother with a very self-satisfied and condescending nod. And it should be noted, it's not like a happy, smiling person, "Here, I brought you this wonderful gift of jam." It's a woman saying, "I'm not going to be in your debt. I'm not going to let you have this thing over me. Here, you gave me the berries. Here's the jam." Huh. And she nods her head and walks away. But the mother, not realizing what has happened, is now in this woman's debt because she has now been given a gift. So she retaliates by baking a cake. And she takes it to this other woman and she gives her the cake, and she does that same frown, literally a condescending glare on her face, and she nods her head. "Here, here's your cake." And then she walks away. And the other woman has to retaliate again because this obligation is now passed to her. And so she bakes a bigger cake. And she takes it to the woman with the kids. And at that point, the mother with the children sees this absolutely massive, beautiful cake. And she opens the door and lets the other woman in so that they can share the cake. And that was a way of the mutual obligation breaking down the barriers once it had begun, because the children had given that unsolicited gift, the original berries. It's a subtle series of scenes that may be lost on most people, but that is what it is, and that is what was happening. And that's where it comes from, the mutual obligation. I highly encourage you to watch that movie. So, this kind of spirit of gift-giving, especially around this one particular day and one particular time, the celebration of Christ's Mass, became a rather important and pervasive, at least locally. Well, locally for now. It did tend to expand, as many good ideas do. So Nicholas is no longer a wealthy man. He becomes the bishop. He becomes an older man with white hair, but he is still helping those who need help. And he begins to intercede, to step in on behalf of people that he thought were falsely accused of crimes. And that is how he became the patron saint of those that are falsely accused. Which is why, later, he also became the patron saint of repentant thieves. Now, that's an easy transition to understand. It's almost a logical one. The prayer would be something like, oh, please, oh, Nicholas, Saint Nicholas, help me. I didn't do the thing that they are accusing me of. I am falsely accused. Please help me. I'm going to change my life. If you only let me get out of this one, I'll be a better person. Then, so he becomes the saint of repentant thieves who are praying for him to intercede on their behalf to get them off and so they won't go to prison. So that's fun. And that kind of explains some of the origins of the gift-giving a little bit. Later on, though, things took a turn, a pretty dark turn. And by the by, this story is a little dark. No, that's not true. This next story is not a little dark, it is very dark. Hundreds of years later, there was an addition to the stories involving St. Nicholas that is, well, as I said, rather dark. I will not be graphic or descriptive here. I am not going to include all of the details. I'm going to use very simple but very obfuscated language. You may read between the lines as you will. And if someone asks, if a small person asks you what did that mean, feel free to say whatever you like. St. Nicholas was visiting an area that was stricken by famine. They had completely run out of food, and he had brought, as the bishop, he had brought food and was trying to distribute it to the people that were starving so that they wouldn't die. And in conversations with the people that are around there, he discovered that there was a specific man, a butcher, that was still selling meat, which was incredible because he was the only person that had meat. And where did he get this meat? Well, in his discovery and his discussions and conversations and investigations, he discovered that there was a barrel of brine. Brine is salt water, basically, that is used to cure mainly pork, salted pork being a very wonderful dish that keeps a long time. And he discovered in a barrel of brine there were three boys, small boys, and St. Nicholas performed a miracle and brought them back to life. So they were resurrected. They were alive. Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas. Yeah, that's maybe literally the most dark story involving Christmas anywhere in the Christmas tradition. But there you go. I bring it up because as horrible as it is, and it is definitely horrible, back in the Middle Ages, it was extraordinarily popular. This is a story that everybody loved, and they loved retelling. It was so popular that it became a story that they would tell every year on Christmas. As part of the celebration of Christ's Mass and the mutual gift giving, they would tell the story of St. Nicholas and the three boys. It was so popular that there began to be paintings, like lots of them, of this particular act, and really beautiful, ornate paintings that would have taken quite a bit of time to paint. And I should say that this story really did just appear in the Middle Ages. It appeared nowhere in the early writings about St. Nicholas. Before Nicholas became St. Nicholas, it doesn't exist anywhere. St. Nicholas, or rather, Nicholas the Bishop, Nicholas of Myra, was a real person. There's no question about that. Some of the stories around him, well, they develop, and this one would be one of the ones that was developed rather than sourced. Let's put it that way. And so his legend grew. As the paintings became more popular and more of them were made, the paintings are all variations on a theme. Three kids standing up in a barrel right next to Nicholas, who's giving them the sign of the cross, or hugging them, or waving them. They're waving, hugging him, waving their hands about, jumping up and down. Everybody's happy. Very much alive. Those same paintings were rather reinterpreted later, which is why he became the patron saint of brewers, barrel makers, and, of course, small children. So as Nicholas's legend grew basically all over Europe, throughout Christendom, so to speak, but mostly the place that it became the most famous and the most popular, where he really took on, well, his legend took on a life of its own at that point. It really was just growing beyond anyone's expectations or control or anything, was in the Netherlands, which is sometimes called Holland. Although it's not actually Holland, because Holland is just the name for two provinces within the Netherlands. But in the Netherlands, the people speak Dutch, not English. And that's important because he became extraordinarily popular, and the Dutch, because they don't speak English, didn't call him Saint Nicholas. They called him Sinterklaas. And if you think that that sounds suspiciously like Santa Claus, you're right. That's basically where we get it from, although that comes later. And that's where some of the iconography, the iconic pictures of Santa Claus begin to develop. The long white beard, the red outfit. No, it did not come from Coca-Cola. This beautiful red outfit and a white beard, the legend of him giving presents to children with the help of his helper, began to crystallize there in Netherlands many, many centuries ago. That's really where the gift-giving becomes a more central aspect. The gift-giving to the good children became a crucial part of the mythology as it began to develop. Sinterklaas, with the red coat, who would give presents to children, to the good children, with the help of his helper, Black Pete. And if you think that's bad, yeah, it's just as bad as it sounds. Black Pete is a black guy. Small, diminutive, short black guy. Well, originally he was. The recent depictions of Black Pete have completely stopped using a small, dark-skinned Moor as a helper. And instead, they're saying that the legend has been kind of reinterpreted and reimagined, and Black Pete is an elf that has gone down the chimneys, and so there's black streaks from the chimney soot on his clothes and on his skin. But that is actually just a retelling, a reimagining of the original story. The original Black Pete is just as racist as you might think. In Germany, things were a bit different because of Martin Luther and the Reformation. Yeah, odd, but true. It makes perfect sense if you think about it. Martin Luther rebelled against the Catholic Church. He created the Protestant religion rather than the Catholic one. And as part of the Protestant Reformation, eliminating all things Catholic, they eliminated the saints. And if they're eliminating the saints, they are eliminating Saint Nicholas. So the Protestant Reformation under Martin Luther got rid of Saint Nicholas. But if Saint Nicholas has to go, well, he's pretty much center to the celebration of Christmas at this time, on the idea of gift-giving to children, so are you really going to get rid of that? Well, the English did, but we'll talk about that in a minute. In Germany, they took a different tact. They said that gift-giving is still, of course, it's a wonderful thing to do for children, but it's not Saint Nicholas giving the gifts. It's the Christ child, or as they say in German, Christkindl. Later, that name became Anglicanized, and Christkindl became Kris Kringle. And that's where that comes from. Over in England, and to a much lesser extent France, they had another name, another individual, Father Christmas. In the beginning, Father Christmas is not Santa Claus. He just isn't. The original Father Christmas does not bring gifts to children. He is not dressed in red with white fur trimmings. Instead, he's wearing a green robe, and frequently kind of a holly halo. He first appears, he dates back to the 16th century, so the 1500s, about 500 years ago, during the reign of Henry VIII. He was depicted at the time as a very large man, with not a white beard, but a full brown or sometimes red beard. The robes were lined with fur, but not the white fur that you would associate today with Santa Claus, more like the spotted fur that you would associate with royalty and wealth, if that makes sense. And he did not provide Christmas presents. Instead, he provided Christmas cheer. He was the spirit of Christmas, but in the eat, drink, and be merry kind of a way. The image generally given is very similar to what later Charles Dickens would write about during his novel, The Christmas Carol. The spirit of Christmas present, the jolly man who's always eating and singing, that would become a more close depiction of Father Christmas rather than of Santa Claus. But that's who Father Christmas was. And as an interesting side note, or I think so, it makes sense that Father Christmas in England would be the figure associated with merriment and laughter, with fun and feasting, with good food and good drink, because he was outlawed. After the English Revolution, in the 1600s, in the execution of King Charles I, the Puritans, the extraordinarily religious and far fringe, some might say crazy, Christians, they outlawed Christmas. That's right. Like the villain in Christmas movies and TV specials, like the Sheriff of Nottingham in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, the Puritan government in England made Christmas illegal. Officially. It was not unofficial, it was an act of Parliament. You were literally not allowed to celebrate it. Or Easter. And the religious enforcers that roamed the streets of England could arrest you if they found you preparing Christmas food. So if they smelled you roasting a goose the night before Christmas, you could be thrown in jail. It's cartoonishly bad, but it is real. That lasted a little more than a decade. That regime was also a little more than a decade, and then thrown upon the ash heap of history, possibly because they were so bad that they outlawed Christmas. Once they were gone, Christmas came back, and along with Father Christmas, he began to embody all of the celebrations that were denied the English for a decade. So, there we go. It is truly a wide and varied sources to get to where we are. And a kind of a quick and dirty family tree would be St. Nicholas becomes Sinterklaas, and then was in the Netherlands, became the Christkindl. In Germany, became Father Christmas was something different and began to merge with the same idea later, along with Père Noël in France. Truly wide and varied roots. But to get to where we are and our current understanding of Santa Claus, we have to journey across the Atlantic Ocean to America. Because yes, although the roots are very European, Santa Claus, as we know him today, is very much American. In fact, they are very much New Yorkian, which is not a word, but they really did get shaped by New York. Before New York was New York, New York was New Amsterdam, which doesn't really sound the same as the Frank Sinatra song, so I'm not really going to try. New Amsterdam was a Dutch city. When the Dutch came over here, they brought with them their beliefs and celebrations, and specifically, Sinterklaas. The years passed, and I'm definitely not going into that history. But basically, in the early 1600s, the new Dutch settlement on the Hudson River was founded. It was called New Amsterdam. It was Dutch for several decades, then switched over to English. And then, you know what? I'm not going to do it. New Amsterdam was a Dutch settlement that became New York City. There you go. And the celebration of Sinterklaas kind of filtered out into the general population. And he became a very, very popular figure there. 200 years later, when New York City was much more New York City than New Amsterdam. And it was very much American because this was after the American Revolution. One of the great early American authors, Washington Irving, stepped up. He was the man that wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. In 1809, he published a kind of satirical, slightly parody book called A History of New York from the Beginning of the World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty. And because it was kind of a joke, he didn't use his real name. He made up a name, and he called himself Diedrich Knickerbocker. That book was actually one of the first, and as a historian, it's very good that we had these, his first descriptions of the actual practices of Christmas at the time, how we celebrated it in America, and specifically Santa Claus, because Washington Irving is the guy that took Sinterklaas and Americanized it into Santa Claus. And that's really where it comes from. Well, the name at least. As another side note, the term Knickerbocker became a very, very popular thing in New York. And for many, many decades, it was kind of a slang term, just a general term, for a New York resident, a Knickerbocker. So it was so popular that it became the name of a basketball team. The New York Knickerbockers, or rather, the New York Knicks. That is literally where it comes from. It's an NBA team that is based on the fake name of Washington Irving when he wrote the document that essentially created the American Santa Claus. So the real question then becomes, are the New York Knicks Santa's favorite team? Probably. So in that little book, Santa Claus comes to the park. Maybe it's Central Park, maybe not. It would be called something different back then. But it's a fun little tale, which I will now relate to you. This is actually a dream of the character Olaf in the book. But Olaf dreamed a dream. And here you go. And the sage Olaf dreamed a dream. And lo, the good St. Nicholas came riding over the tops of the trees in that selfsame wagon wherein he brings his yearly presents to children. And he descended hard by the heroes of the Communipaw had made their late repast. And he lit his pipe by the fire and sat himself down and smoked. And as he smoked, the smoke from his pipe ascended into the air. and spread out like a cloud overhead. And Olof bethought him, and he hastened and climbed up to the top of one of the tallest trees, and he saw that the smoke spread over a great extent of the country. And as he considered it more attentively, he fancied that a great volume of smoke assumed a various and variety of marvelous forms, where in dim obscurity he saw shadowed out palaces and domes and lofty spires, all of which lasted but a moment, and then faded away, until the whole rolled off and nothing but the green woods were left. When St. Nicholas had smoked his pipe, he twisted it into his hatband, and laying a finger aside his nose, gave the astonished Olaf a very significant look, then mounting his wagon, he returned over the treetops and disappeared. So there you go. That's the first depiction and description of Santa Claus. And not Sinterklaas, not Christ the King, not Kris Kringle, not Père Noël, not Father Christmas, but Santa Claus. That's the first one. And you can actually see the roots of what has become the tradition of Santa Claus. There, the flying wagon bringing gifts to children, the laying a finger aside of his nose, smoking his pipe, it's all there. But it became much more codified, much more relatable, and much more crystallized in the subsequent decades. And it actually happened rather quickly. There is an anonymous poem called Old Santa Claus with Much Delight, written in 1821. We don't know who wrote it, but it does actually describe some of the more modern versions of Santa. Basically, the reindeer and the sleigh are introduced rather than the wagon and the horses. But none of that was fully canon until 1823, when a man named Clement Moore, possibly another guy, probably him, wrote a poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas, which is better known today as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which is really, this does set out the actual canon, the real solid crystallization of the Santa Claus mythology. I'm not going to do the whole thing, but if you have become old and you have forgotten it, 'twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, with hope that St. Nicholas soon would be there. This is the poem that actually establishes the reindeer and their names. Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, Blitzen, but not Rudolph. That came later, about 100 years later. He lands on the roof, comes down the chimney, gives the gifts, and then laying a finger of side of his nose, that's a nod to Washington Irving's earlier story, up the chimney he rose. That also comes with the descriptions of his cheeks. They were like roses, his nose like a cherry, the beard of his chin was as white as the snow, the thumb of his pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. Again, a nod to Washington Irving. And I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night. So that's it. It actually says in the poem, it describes him as a jolly old elf. And that's where we get that. So at this point, the Santa mythology is becoming solidified, but it's not complete yet. It doesn't become complete until a few decades later. At this point, any depictions of Santa are pretty much, they're all this similar. But at that point, he's wearing various things. Always winter outfits, but not the fully codified version that we have. That didn't really come until in the mid-1860s, Harper's Bazaar. Now, this is New York. Again, it's one of the most famous and widely read magazines at the time, and they commissioned an artist to depict Santa Claus for their magazine. He was actually like a political cartoonist. He used to draw caricatures and sketches that were very, very political for the time. He was very liberal. At the time, he was very progressive. He supported the rights for the American Indians, the Native Americans. He was against slavery. So he supported the abolition of slavery. He was against segregation. But he really didn't like the Irish. But nobody's perfect. Thomas Nast was commissioned by Harper's. And for several years, he drew depictions of Santa Claus. And it's those images that were so widely distributed, that were so influential in codifying and establishing a huge number of the aspects of Santa Claus that we know and love today. For instance, it is at this point that he creates a character that is similar to what had been before, but under Nast, he's much bigger and taller. He's no longer a jolly old elf. He's a grand old man, like with kind of a impressive stature. He moves Santa's home up to the North Pole. And it is a little interesting to note that it was an American illustrator that moved Santa up to the North Pole, because other countries have different interpretations and their own beliefs of where Santa Claus lives. So in Finland, they say he lives in Finland. In Sweden, they say he lives in Sweden. In Russia, they say he lives in Russia. In Norway, they say he lives in Norway. Are you sensing a pattern here? They all want to claim ownership of where Santa Claus lives. And in order to avoid any potential issues with that, Nast didn't pick one. He just said, oh, okay, well, he lives in the North Pole, because nobody lives there. Nobody's going to get mad. So everyone just kind of agreed, all right, Santa lives in the North Pole. Well, no, that's not true. In America, everybody just kind of agreed that Santa lives in the North Pole. And in Finland, Sweden, Norway, Russia, they still claim ownership of the location of Santa's home. So much so that there are particular towns in those countries that will literally say, we are the official home of Santa Claus. Are they, though? I mean, really? Maybe. Sure. Have at it. Go for it. I mean, Santa can be whatever you want him to be, really. It's a mythological figure. Where I live in New Orleans, everyone talks about the Cajun Christmas where, and this is not a joke, Santa is pulled through the air by 8 flying alligators. That's a Cajun Christmas, and yeah, there you go. Everyone kind of put their own spin and flavor on it, and that continued a little bit. About 50 years later, L. Frank Baum, the guy that wrote Wizard of Oz, in 1900, 2 years later, wrote another book called The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus. And he attempted to add to the Santa Claus mythology, and it didn't work. For whatever reason, at this point, adding things to the Santa mythology, they weren't sticking. So he was a very famous author at the time, and he fleshed out a decent story, but nobody really brought it into their hearts. It's not a bad book. I read it when I was younger. It's not terrible. It really, you know, it's okay. Basically, in his story, he takes a wood carver who's raised by fairies in the Laughing Forest of Ho Ha Ho, or Ha Ho Ha, I forget. But when he leaves the Enchanted Forest, he goes into the real world and becomes a woodcarver and brings toys to children to make them happy. And he's such a good and wonderful person that the other immortals that L. Frank Baum just kind of made up on his own, the other immortal beings granted him the gift of immortality so that Santa Claus could live forever. There was one of those stop-motion animation, the claymation Christmas specials made, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, about that, and it's not great. Anyway, so the mythology of Santa Claus kind of stagnated, it crystallized, and then it would become even more crystallized with Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola beginning to advertise Santa Claus in a very specific way, although they didn't invent the red suit that goes all the way back to Sinterklaas hundreds of years ago. There are depictions in the 1800s of Santa Claus in red and white. What they really did do is made it only that. That there were other depictions of Santa wearing green robes or what have you, and all of that went away after Coca-Cola began to market Santa Claus drinking Coca-Cola in a very, very specific way. And that really became the only image of Santa that we think of now. That really began in the 1930s. In the end of the 1930s came the last, really the last very well-known piece of the Santa Claus mythology. And that came not from New York this time, but from Chicago. A department store, Montgomery Ward, in order to sell a specific thing that only they would have access to. They chose a coloring book because they're cheap to make. When you don't have to color them in. That's what the kids do. So it's just cheap paper with, you know, black lines on white paper. They would sell a specific coloring book, and that coloring book was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And that's where that comes from. The song has a very specific history, and if you're curious about that, I would encourage you to go back a few months in my archive and listen to the Christmas Carol episode that I put up last year while I was drinking. So I become more and more intoxicated as the episode goes by. But not in a bad way. In the 1950, C.S. Lewis published The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and in there is a description of Father Christmas, who finally gets to return to Christmas when the White Witch's spell is broken in Narnia. And if you're familiar with that book, you know what I'm talking about, and if you're not, don't worry about it. Christmas happens, and the important part for our purposes is that C.S. Lewis's depiction of Father Christmas at that point was very much a mixture of Santa Claus and the original Father Christmas. He shows up in a sleigh, he gives presents and gifts to the children, but he also, as he leaves a feast behind where all of the Narnia creatures to eat, drink, and be merry. So that is a mixture, that is now the coming together of Father Christmas and Santa Claus, and it is clearly depicted in C.S. Lewis's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And this brings us to the final piece, the final thing, the most Christmassy of all the Christmas traditions, nuclear war. NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. Yes, they do track Santa Claus on Christmas Eve. And the origin story is actually pretty good. It's better than I thought it would be. Of course, I wanted to put this in this little podcast episode. And so when I looked up and read the story, this is significantly more interesting than I had really originally thought. So here you go. It begins sort of on December 24th, 1948. The United States Air Force issued a communique claiming that an early warning radar net to the north had detected one unidentified sleigh powered by 8 reindeer at 14,000 feet, heading 180 degrees. This official communique was passed on to the Associated Press, which then reported it to the general public. But it was a one-time thing. Nothing really happened after that until Sears, and yes, that is the store, Sears, made a mistake. In 1955, in order to kind of increase their market share, the Sears department store placed an ad in newspapers all over the country of Santa, and this is, I'm reading this here, "Hey kiddies, call me direct on my telephone. Call me on my private phone and I will talk to you personally anytime, day or night, or come in and visit me at the Sears Toyland. Signed, Santa Claus." The telephone number given out was ME26681. The only problem with that is that was a misprint and that was the wrong number. Because if you dialed that number, what you got was the United States Air Force, Colorado Springs Continental Air Defense Command. And on this particular night, Air Force Colonel Harry Shoup was manning his desk. The phone began to ring. Harry picks it up. Continental Air Defense Command, this is Colonel Harry Shoup speaking.
Is this Santa Claus?
What?
Is this Santa Claus?
No, this is not Santa Claus. This is the Continental Air Defense Command. Colonel Harry Shoup speaking. In the course of this little conversation, the colonel figures out what's going on, and he informs the child that Santa Claus is just fine. Go to bed. Hangs up the phone. But then he gets another call, and it's the same thing. It's a kid looking for Santa Claus. And then another one. And then another one. Finally, the colonel ends up telling his duty officer to just tell anyone who calls that we are tracking Santa and that Santa Claus is just fine. They even, kind of getting into the spirit of the thing, begin to map his current location for Santa Claus. So they would tell all the kids where he was. He's currently flying over New York. He has gone south and he is over Tennessee, heading towards Mississippi or what have you. It became a thing, and it still is a thing. Currently, if you call the number NORAD with about 1,000 volunteers, receives over 100,000 phone calls every year asking about the whereabouts and the safety of Santa Claus. And they have their website. You can look this up on December 24th. There is an official NORAD United States military website tracking Santa Claus during Christmas Eve, and with the ultimate assurances that he is just fine. The official release the year after this began was that the Army, the Navy, the Marines, and the Air Forces will continue to track and guard Santa and his sleigh on his trip to and from the United States against possible attack from those who do not believe in Christmas. If you want to call, the number is actually very, very simple. It, oddly enough, is 1-877-HI-NORAD. That's H-I-N-O-R-A-D. The volunteers that man the phones currently say that the most common questions they get is, where is Santa? When is Santa coming to my house? And am I on the naughty or nice list? The answer to that one is invariably yes, as long as you're asleep before Santa comes. Who knew international nuclear defense could be so festive? I'm going to close this with just two descriptions of my two favorite Santa Claus movies. The current movies and Santa Claus mythology, they really are just kind of a retelling of two aspects. One, the origin story of Santa Claus, and two, Santa Claus in the modern world. And I personally think that the best two movies about that in the last several decades and possibly ever are Klaus, as I mentioned earlier, and another one, a really underrated gem of a movie called Arthur Christmas, which is top-notch. But those are just my opinions, and of course yours may differ. And if anything, as this little trip through history has shown, is that the opinions and the depictions, the variations of Santa Claus are wide and varied across the world. So whatever you find to be the most appropriate or appealing, just go with that one. It's totally fine. And now hear me explain, as I ride out of sight, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night. This has been Storied History. I do hope you have enjoyed it. If you did, please give us a like, rate us a 5-star review, hit the subscribe button. I'm going to celebrate Christmas And in the new year, I will be looking for the next story. And if you hit the subscribe button, I will be sure to get it to you. They're always longer than I anticipated. I thought this was going to be half an hour. Oh well, hope you enjoyed it.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut in New Orleans, Louisiana, with audio production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, and we'll see you soon.